Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey. This week's episode, we are traveling back in time to the 1927 silent film Sunrise, or Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, directed by the German director F.W. Murnau, starring George O'Brien and Janet Gaynor. For those who haven't seen the film, a farmer, bored with everyday life, is seduced by a woman from the city to murder his wife so they may run away together. So, Dad, why did you pick Sunrise out of all the silent films in the world? Why did you pick this one?
To be our first silent film that we talk about?
Yes.
There's two reasons. One, I really liked the cinematography when I was in film school. It was one of the movies that when we were studying cinematography from film history that we kind of got to see that film. Silent films weren't that herky-jerky, badly shot, locked-down camera film. There were a lot of moving cameras, a lot of tracking shots, and the unlocked camera. And it's actually quite a beautiful film to watch. There's a lot of optical effects in it that are done in real time that are really kind of cool. And so I thought it would be fun to watch. It's also kind of like a lot of the things that when people watch silent films now, unless they're studying silent films, we kind of know the comedies, like the Max Sennett comedies and Laurel and Hardy and those type of silent films that were really popular, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, and we don't really study much of the dramas. I thought it would be kind of nice to kind of just go into a drama.
So why Sunrise specifically, especially since F.W. Murnau is known for other films above Sunrise?
I kind of like it. I kind of think it's his best film, actually, out of all his films. I know he's famous for making Nosferatu and a couple other films. And I think if you talk to people now, the one that they would have recognized or kind of they can remember would be Nosferatu, because it was like the first vampire film, really. And it set that. It set the horror genre up in
one of many to come out of Germany at this time.
Yeah, but it was like the one that internationally, and because it became a cult classic too, because you couldn't find it, so people started searching out. It was like considered like the first cult classic film, because after he was done making it, and Nosferatu went out, the estate of Bram Stoker sued him in the studio. And said, you have to get rid of it and destroy the copies. He lost in court. The court said, you have to get rid of it. And actually, the one thing that saved it is that it was actually pushed out globally. And there was a couple copies left. So people were able to copy the film. And so it was saved that way. But it became a cult classic because they couldn't like show it for real in Europe. It kind of survived in America. And so it's kind of cool that he's like one of he created the first cult film that also happened to be a horror film, which is why I think cult films and horror films are kind of tied together. But also with Sunrise, the thing that I really liked about it is it's one of those films that's really refined and really interesting to watch. And it's such a different film from his earlier work, but you can see all the way that he shot it was there. He used shadows a lot and things like that. So
all the German expressionist tropes, which, by the way, for those who don't know, German expressionism was an art movement after World War I. And I say art movement because it's not specifically defined to cinema. It's not a cinema movement. It also happens in their poetry, in their paintings.
And their plays.
And their plays, where
And that's where Murnau started.
Where Murnau started, where German artists focused on artists' feelings or the subject's feelings and emotions more than reality or what's happening. It's more about getting in the mind of your characters, which is where we see these common tropes of stylized sets, mirrors, elongated shadows, optical effects within the German movement.
Yeah, and if you watch more and more of the films, you'll see it spread out and used in different ways, and different directors use the expressionism in different ways. But I think the main thing that we talk to really kind of walk away from this is that we always kind of view audiences from an earlier generation as simpler. They wouldn't quite understand the films that we make, or the films that we make now are more complex realistic. You hear that all the time. It's like when people watch a movie from the 40s or the 50s or the 60s and they go, well, this movie's simple or slow, or the story is too black and white, and it wouldn't play with today's audiences. I like to point to Sunrise as a film that is not only complex, both in drama and emotion. It relies more on the interpretation, the audience being able to interpret the story and what's going on and interpret what's going on in front of them versus having it spoon-fed to them. And I think that's one of the things, too, that one of the reasons why I like this film is that it's a good example of showing that in some ways we have this rule in our modern filmmaking. If it's not presented in the film, it's not based in reality, it's not rooted or grounded, then it's not a real, and this is like a film that uses techniques that aren't rooted or grounded. They're based in emotion, and the camera work and the actors are showing you the emotional state of the characters versus, what's going on and what versus what's going on in a quote unquote real scene. And so there's a lot of, it almost has a dreamy aspect in certain cases. And I really enjoy the fact that it's really fun to watch. And as I've watched it in different points of my life, I've interpreted it differently.
Do you think that because the characters don't have names, George O'Brien's character is called the man, Janet Gaynor is characters named the wife. Do you think that this allows them to be turned into universal symbols?
Kinda. I mean, I think the thing is that how many times in a film do you actually hear a main character being given using their whole name? But I do think it also allows the mind to kind of like separate the characters, and the characters do, like you said, become a representation of society. So you'll be able to look at society through these characters. They become more archetypes than an actual full-fledged, character. So you're watching things move. You're seeing both the characters interact and then the archetype and how the archetype interacts in society. So yeah, I enjoy the fact that the movie is so, in some ways, so straightforward, and in other ways, so interpretive, that it's just like, there's a man, there's a woman, there's a mistress, go. So we have this rule when we watch movies about, especially in rom-coms, you see it a lot now, if there's a fatal flaw in the relationship, meaning if there's something that the relationship has to overcome that is too great really for the relationship to overcome. An example was, we watched a rom-com over Christmas where literally the whole point of them getting together was one of them was catfishing the other. And then eventually they fall in love. And it's like, wait, if you were catfished, you probably wouldn't fall in love with that person.
No. Yeah. It was Love Hard, a Netflix original.
Yeah. And so it's like there's movies like that where there's a fatal flaw. It's like the meet cute shouldn't put the relationship.
It shouldn't be a crime, and it shouldn't be a deception.
Yeah, basically, not put the, as I view it, not put the relationship in such a deficit that you can never dig out of that deficit.
Yes,
and realistically.
Yes, and to me, the attempted murder of both the mistress and the wife by the man kind of put that into the deficit for me.
Well, so let's walk it back, because you kind of gave a really quick thing. So the farmer is bored in everyday diet life. The mistress is staying in the town the farmer lives in. Why, we don't know. It's not part of the story, really. And she convinces the farmer that if he got rid of the wife, they can run off together. Why they just didn't run off together, I don't know.
I never understand. In real life and in movies.
So they live in a bay, and they have a small little hamlet on one side of the bay, and then across the bay is a larger town. And they row the boat across back and forth. The people in this town row their boats back and forth to go to the town. And the farmer decides the next time that he's going to the town, he's going to, and with his wife on the boat, either choke his wife and throw in the water or drown her or something. And as he's doing it, as he gets halfway across, he attacks her, but then comes to his senses while he's attacking her. She's like frightened as all get out. He takes her to the other side. She runs away into the town and he follows her. And then they have this whole day from day to through night, where their relationship is out, and eventually they patch up everything, and he realizes he's really in love with his wife. She realizes she's really in love with him, and they patch everything up and they go back to their house in the hamlet across the bay. As they're crossing the bay, a storm comes up. He tries to save her, and then he wakes up on the beach. She's missing. He thinks she's died. And then he takes his anger out on his mistress, like you said. But they find her, and then everything is fine. And then they run off together. And the mistress runs off into the sunset.
To me, this feels more of like one of those fairy tales that you read about.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it makes sense that a man attacking a woman is fine because it was made a really long time ago. And that was fine, you know?
Well, it has a root in fairy tales and some of the Germanic stories that I've read have, I don't want to say that they're full of it, but they have relationships that we would consider today toxic and or have toxic elements to them, and we would be talking about it like that. But I think the thing is that as you read more into it and as you watch it, I find that's the thing of the man's character is the violence he portrays into the world. And I do think there's a little bit of that. The man is the beast and the woman is the one that quells the beast in the story. And his wife is the one who eventually quells the beast.
Well, I definitely,
and the other woman was one that was trying to use the beast.
I definitely got, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this so you can edit it out, but I definitely got a Madonna whore complex from the two female characters. You know, one's all bad because she's into her.
Oh yeah, they're archetypes.
Sensuality. She has her modern hair because, you know, the 1920s, the short hair, the short skirts, the boots, the stockings with the lines that the camera focuses on for a little second, and then the wife has more of like, lack for a better term, a Victorian turn of the century look, where she has like,
she's very pure. She's in light colors, almost white. She represents pure, and the mistress is in darker colors, definitely not pure.
Yeah.
And so yeah, but as you notice throughout the day where the wife and the man are together, she becomes less pure, and I think that's a. There's like her hair gets long, you know, she unbraids her hair, gets, you know what I'm saying? There's all this stuff that happens that tells you that she's kind of, she's opening herself up to him. And all these visual symbols that she's opening herself up to him.
And that he's opening up to her because he gets his hair cut, he gets a shave, he becomes very like clean cut and proper, lack for a better term. I also like the shot. There was an ending shot after she gets taken out of the river where she's in bed and she has her hair around her, and she's wearing like a flowy nightgown. It's definitely reminiscent of like Sleeping Beauty and things like that. So I definitely really enjoyed that, and I think that
there's a lot of visual references to
fairy tales
and fairy tales and the poems and some of the opera stuff, and even and I think the thing is that the way that the camera is capturing that, there's definitely, that's on purpose. There's probably references that we don't even get now because we were not in 1920s Germany. So there's probably certain shots set up certain ways that would, would mean more. We can kind of see the references and in art and in poetry and stuff like that. But there's probably even more if I was like living in Germany at that time, I would be able to recognize, especially being post-war Germany.
Well, this is also his first film with Fox for Hollywood.
Yeah, so he comes over to America, and so he's also, and I think we have to remember that the full name of the movie is Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans. There's definitely a lyrical sense to this film, a poetic sense to this film.
There's like these lines at the beginning of the movie because, nothing is said. It's all in text in those title cards. In the beginning, title cards talks about like every human has a song, and then it couples with another person to create a new song, and that's how you find your soulmate. And I definitely remember somebody telling me that there's like a myth or a story about that somewhere. It's where everybody has a song. It's like similar to like the red string, where everybody has a red string on their wrist or hand or something.
Yeah,
that's invisible and attached to your soulmate, or the Greek myth of everybody was a two-headed,
eight-limbed
person that was cut in half, and now they're trying to find their other half. So I definitely feel like there was a story at one point someone told me that was very similar to. So
yeah, and one of the things too is that when they were constructing the story, they obviously were going for the roots they were going after roots that have been there for a while. They weren't over a modern story tale. I mean, there's definitely iconic shots that are meant to line up with certain characters from the past. And so as you see it and you can reference it and go, okay.
So you mentioned this unchained camera.
Yeah, well, that's what they kind of called it. So lock cameras, when cameras were first being used, they were locked, quote unquote, locked down, which means that the tripod or whatever the camera's mounted to was not moving. It was locked down. It would film a shot. The action would happen in front of it. They might move the camera and reshoot it and edit together. And so you end up with, so it feels like the scene is moving, but the camera literally isn't. And then in the teens, they started experimenting with moving cameras, putting them on, trucks. Literally, that's why it's called a dolly shot, and then back of trucks, and they're pulling it, and the cowboys are chasing, running along the truck. Or
I heard that in this particular film, his cinematographer rode like a bike, strapped to his chest and rode it on a bike.
Yeah, and there's different ways where they would hang it. They would hang it on kind of like what we do with the NFL films now, where you have that camera in the middle of the film in the thing. They would hang it on things, and they would move it because it was easier to do that than try to get it in and around things. It'd be very short takes like that. It wouldn't be like the long ones you see now. But there's just different techniques that they tried. And some of them were really successful. Some of them stuck, and some of them didn't. But the idea was to get the camera out moving and following people. And they did a lot of that in this film. In fact, there's a really great scene where they get off the boat and she's running away from her husband and he's following her through the crowded city. And you're just watching the camera follow them through the city as she's trying to get away from him and collect her thoughts. And in today's world, we would look at that and go, that's no big deal. But in that world, it's like you can see how practiced and how good it was. And it's just like, it just shows you that this type of moving camera was very common in this end of the silent era. In fact, they got really good at using their cameras. And the thing that stopped them from advancing farther in that thing was sound. Because when sound came, the mics weren't good enough. And so they had to stop moving the camera. They had to put blimps on it. They had to lock it down again. They had, you know, it's like they had to kind of start all over again to get the sound integrated. And so that's why you watch a lot of 30s films and the camera is like just stops. And that's why there's
feels
a lot.
Like you're watching a play.
Yeah. Or, yeah. And it's like, and so, or if you are watching the camera move, it's in an action sequence outside, like in a Western, where
there's no dialogue
and they can record the hoofbeats and the horse running and all that stuff. And it's much easier to hide the sound of the camera, but also make it work. So it's like, so when you watch these movies towards the end of the silent era, there's like how freeing the camera is and how they were able to do all this stuff. It came to an end at the, when sound was introduced. In fact, his last two films that did only okay, The Last Laugh, and I forget the other one, were actually shot as silent film, and they made him go back and kind of do this like hybrid silent film, sound film thing. And they both weren't accepted very well because he had to, you know, they felt stagey, and he never really liked them because they weren't his original vision. And in fact, he started doing a lot of that towards the end when these films that were actually shot silent were, then they would go back and reshoot certain scenes to make them quote unquote talkies. How'd you feel about the sound on this one? The soundtrack that you were hearing was actually the soundtrack that was designed for this film back in when it was made. It was just sound effects and music. And they didn't have any dialogue, but it was meant to immerse you in the world. How'd you feel that was?
I mean, it was definitely primitive in my mind. When it comes to the background noise, it kind of feels like when you watch one of those YouTube videos explaining like a topic and they're just like, they're like trying to give you like fun noises to make you think of Rome or whatever history topic you're talking about. So they just have general like horse beats and talking crowd and man laugh one, man laugh two. Like that's kind of how it felt to me, but it's not. It didn't take away from the story in the sense that, you know, like the Wilhelm scream does every time it comes up to the story, my brain goes, as a Wilhelm scream, what, you know.
But I was thinking more like that scene where she bursts out into the city and then you hear all the traffic and you hear the horns and, you know, and stuff like that. And it, like, did it add to the scene for you or did it?
Yeah, it did. I mean, it's hard to say that it added to the scene for me.
Or did you even feel it? Or did you just expect it to be there because you're used to sound in film?
I honestly think that's probably the latter. Like, it's really hard to answer that question because I'm expecting noise. It sounded more like a soundscape to me than, like, real noise. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think it's supposed to... Which added to the
impressionistic ideas of the movie.
Yeah, I felt like it was like giving you a sense of the landscape, but not defining the landscape. And then towards the end, when it got kind of like not ghostly, but you know what I'm saying, like eerie. And I think it was trying to add to the sense. And I can see what you say it would be very primitive, but for me, I'm sitting there thinking in the 1927 or 26 when they were making this film, to sit there and figure that out and go, we're actually going to put the soundtrack on the film so people can actually, it will travel with the film. So everybody's going to hear the same soundtrack. It won't matter if you're going to the really fancy theater where there's an orchestra or the really poor theater where there's a piano player. It's like you're going to hear the same soundtrack in every theater because at that point they had what's called an optical soundtrack, which meant they ran a strip down the side of the film that had the soundtrack in it, and it was optically played through the camera the projector would interpret it optically, and then that would produce the sound. And so there's people who are way better technologically that could tell you how that exactly worked. But I thought that was fascinating to me. It's like at that time in 1926 and 27, when we thought that people with sound and stuff were very primitive, they were able to figure this stuff out and actually build it into the film and have somebody build a soundtrack that immersed you into this world. So I don't know. I've always kind of enjoyed it. When I first saw the film, though, I saw a version that was called the American cut. They call it the movie tone.
Movie tone, yeah.
Movie tone cut. And that one, I watched it and was pretty amazed. But because they were putting that optical soundtrack on it, they cut a little bit off the left side of the frame all the way through the film. So it's missing. So what we watched, the Czech version, which was supposed to be the full frame, and then they were able to, because it's DVD, layer in the music and the soundtrack from the optical
soundtrack. Which also meant that our title cards were in Czech.
Czech. So we actually had to have subtitles for a silent film, which is kind of funny.
Which adds to this point of silent films being a little bit more. When I was doing some research for this, there was this man who said that this was the first time that, or this is the first and only time, arguably, that, I'm paraphrasing here, arguably, that cinema was global.
Yes.
That it was
truly global.
Truly global because of the fact that nobody had sound. So it's like, if you see a person crying, you don't need it to be in your language. You understand what they're going through. And I think also when it comes to not just silent films, but films that have this like hyper-realistic interpretation, focusing on emotions, expressionism, it also allows a little bit more of a deeper connection because of the fact that it has no language barrier, so you can see the action, but also it's visual poetry, so people can interpret it any way that they want, depending on their culture, depending on who they are, depending on what situation they're going on right now.
Yes. I mean, I think that's one of the things that made silent films great. I mean, one of the things, too, that I kind of do like about this is that Hollywood was making silent films, you know, putting them out. That's why you had Charlie Chaplin famous around the world, because they could just change the title card to whichever country they were sending the movie to. And in the 30s, you would end up with the same movie being filmed in Hollywood in different languages. They would, like, the famous story, of course, of like Dracula, where during the day they shot the English language version of Dracula, and at night they shot the Spanish language version of Dracula.
Yeah, which if you ever have a chance to go watch it back to back, I would highly recommend it, because they were supposed to do shot for shot, but they didn't, and it's kind of fun to watch it.
Well, I also think that the cool thing is that it's a way of showing that you could hand two different directors the same script, and you're going to end up with a similar movie, but not the same movie.
Well, one of the reasons why I really like theater is because of the fact that everybody gets a similar or the same script, and then a director and the actors make a new material based on the same show and same musical. And I always found that movies should do that. Instead of making remakes where somebody comes in and writes a new script, it would be really fun for somebody to take the same script from the 80s and try to figure out how to make it something new but with the same material. And I just always feel like that's a missed opportunity. But I also understand that this is a different medium and I'm a naive person.
No, I understand what you're saying, but it's very similar to like when you are doing, let's say you take one of our favorite topics, Shakespeare play, and you're doing Romeo and Juliet, and you cross out scenes or lines, or you reassign lines. That's the same as a rewrite or for a film. It's like you may not have a person there rewriting, quote unquote, rewriting it, but you are reframing the text and reassembling it as part of your reinterpretation. I think the thing that really bugs me in remakes is everybody tries to fix the quote unquote what they think is wrong with the first take. So like, and so when you, eventually they're going to remake Star Wars, right? Eventually somewhere down the line, like 20 years from now, 25 years from now, they're going to go, okay, maybe not even that long.
I don't even think it's going to be that long.
But they're gonna say, okay, we're going to redo the series because we want to get different actors in here. We want to explore some of this other stuff that we've been exploring and put it into the original series. That's fine. They're going to end up redoing it. And they're going to, and the person who's making it is going to want to fix what they think is the flaws instead of accentuating what's the best parts about it. And 9 times out of 10, when I watch a remake, they're trying to fix something that's a flaw instead of what made this movie great. I mean, a good example is The Italian Job, of not trying to fix the flaws. What made the first Italian Job great? Well, it was the chase. It was the crime. It was the double cross.
Michael Caine.
It was Michael Caine. Well, you couldn't get Michael Caine, but so when they went and they made the remake, they didn't try to fix some of the obvious flaws of the original Italian Job. They decided the best part was the humor, the whole heist thing, and the double cross. So we're going to put that in. We're going to make that's going to be the focus of the movie, and it works out. You can decide whether or not you like the new Italian Job based on the actors and everything like that. But they didn't focus on the flaws. If that makes, you know, does that make sense?
Yes. So also, there's this one movie that we really enjoy. It's called The Thomas Crown Affair.
Yeah, Thomas Crown Affair.
I really like both versions, but there's definitely one that has won my heart, and that is the one with Steve McQueen. There's definite obvious flaws within the film.
Yeah.
Because you only, you know, it's a 60s film and you only get an hour and a half to make this story. When it comes to the Pierce Brosnan version, they try too hard to fix the mistakes and like, where did he get his money? And then there's like this whole monologue and you're like, okay, this is boring. I didn't really want to know where he got his money. Or
yeah, he was just rich in the other one.
And, yeah.
Or was he, you know?
Yeah. Or was he like a spy? Was this supposed to be like a con? What was this? And they put too much effort into like,
yeah,
explaining it. That though it does have some fun, like James Bondy-esque parts, because he was James Bond at this time. So they wanted to like up that ante. It gets boring in the middle because it's just long conversations about, I'm a rich man and this is what I do because I'm bored, you know? It's like, the holes, because the holes made it cool.
Yeah, so, and sometimes, that's what I'm trying to say, sometimes trying to fix the problem, it's like, instead of accentuating issues. So,
we're getting off the topic. If it's just a flawed movie, let it be flawed. So, let's get back on track, because we all love movie history. So early film history in Hollywood.
Yes.
Talk about it.
What do you mean? Like the reason why they went to Hollywood is to escape the patents from the East Coast when they were filming in New Jersey and New York?
Yeah, which is actually quite fun. The reason why Hollywood's in L.A. is because it's the farthest away from Thomas Edison, the not inventor of the movie phone.
Well,
I say not inventor because there's definitely proof that he did not invent most of the things that he says that he invented.
Well, he had a crew.
Yeah.
But I think the thing is that on the West Coast, there was a couple different places that were popping up for filmmaking. In fact, we live not far from one in Niles Canyon in the Bay Area that started to become a film area. In fact, that's where Charlie Chaplin first did some of his first stuff. But Niles being out in the middle of nowhere and not attached to any of the major cities in the Bay Area ended up kind of collapsing, and most people moved to L.A. Another reason why L.A. was very popular is that you could shoot natural light, good lighting for most of the year, and most movies were shot at that time with natural lighting. Even the studios were beveled so that the natural lighting was coming in. They could aim the sunlight and do scenes in stuff. So it really helped their filming. Had a really nice glow to it. There was a lot of space, so they could build their studios, and they could, you know, like you said, be far away from the patents in New York and New Jersey and do what they wanted to do. So that's, and then you had different people starting different studios, but Thomas Ince was the one that, who basically created the modern version of the studio, kind of like that factory style of you have your editors, your directors, you know, the writers in the bungalows writing stories, and it's all like boom, 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 boom. You have the actors under control. He's the one that really pushed that, and then pretty much everybody else took his ideas and created their own versions of that studio system.
So during the late 1920s, during this period of time, this is when Hollywood figured out how to mass produce cinema.
Well, it goes, it backs up. In the teens is when they really start laying a lot of the groundwork. But what happens is, and I think this is the thing that people tend to, it's like a lot of the work the rewards they get in the 20s, they did a lot of the hard work in the teens where they're like building the studios and figuring out the ups and downs and all that stuff. And by the 20s, they have honed it and figured it out.
Well, because they have honed it and figured it out, of course, people are going to get upset as a new art form is being made, just like the boomers are getting upset at TikTok right now. The boomers of the 1920s got upset at cinema and our films and movies and talkies.
Talkies didn't come till the end of the decade.
But they got upset, so they created, and long story short, something called the Hays Code, which was named after somebody named Hays. And
well, yes.
And one of the rules for the Hays Code was that you could show as much vice and as you wanted, only if virtue prevailed in the end. And Hays, an evangelical Christian.
Yes.
So he was really big on this. And I think you can kind of see that in this movie, in Sunrise, where he's cheating on his wife, adultery. He's trying to commit murder multiple times.
Uh-huh.
We all know murder is a sin. All these things that are considered vice and evil and things like that. But virtue at the end, the love of his wife and him turning to, quote unquote, the good side of becoming a family man, loving his wife, ditching the mistress. Mistress. To me, you can definitely see the Hays Code. If I was telling the story, or if somebody now was telling the story, she would have probably died in the river because it's kind of like moral karma or whatever say.
Well, there was movies that were made at that time where if he had killed her, he would have the virtue coming at the end would have been he would have gone insane or something like that, and with his grief, and then he never would have lived the life that he wanted. And you know, there are movies made. There was a movie called Greed, which is deals kind of like with that, where I think the thing with the Hays Code is the Hays Code really, like, there was movies back in the early 20s, especially the early 20s, where there was nudity and there was people killing somebody and getting away with it and things like that. That wasn't every movie. That was just certain movies. And of course, these movies got sensationalized, and they weren't even movies from Hollywood, or some of them were from Europe. But the idea is that the Hays Code came in there like, we're going to make rules because we want to make sure that, you know, if some random kid walked into this film, they wouldn't see something bad.
F.W. Murnau's next quote-unquote famous film, Taboo, was censored in America because of the Polynesian women who were naked in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, the Hays Code is one of those things where I kind of go back and forth on. So you watch some of the greatest movies made during the Hays Commission, their Hays Code, and it's like, it's amazing. They're amazing films. And they had to do all that stuff, and they talked about all that stuff with the Hays Code. And then there's parts where I'm like, I just wish they didn't have the Hays Code, because there's a lot of films were edited for America or
which we did talk about in our Kind Hearts and Cornets.
Yeah, they're edited for America, and then they are different in Europe. Sometimes it's only a scene or a shot or, you know, a clip here and there. But it does change the tone of the movie, and it does make the movie a little different as talking about certain things. So I go back and forth.
So our actors are Janet Gaynor and George O'Brien are our two main leads in this film.
Yes.
George O'Brien, a fun fact about him, his father was the San Francisco police chief.
Commissioner.
Commissioner who arrested Fatty Arbuckle in September of 1921.
Yeah, for the thing that pretty much took down Fatty Arbuckle, which is considered like the first major scandal of Hollywood, which actually leads to the Hayes Commission, which is kind of...
Yeah, so it's kind of like a full circle.
Yep.
And George O'Brien was actually a popular-ish leading man until World War II, where he re-enlisted into the Navy, and then he kind of just like did bit parts after the war.
Well, it's funny. It's like he just would kind of come out and do like these John Ford movies, and work with John Wayne a little bit, or there was a certain directors he would work with, and he didn't really. Like the first time I saw George O'Brien was when I watched the John Wayne film She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and I didn't realize that he had this whole history. And then as I started doing more and more film history, it's like, oh, this guy comes all the way through. I think it's kind of interesting to me that he just kind of picked. He was one of those actors during a studio system who didn't lock himself into a contract after World War II. So he could just pick and choose who you wanted to work with. Mm-hmm. So when his buddies called
up. Which was mostly John Ford.
Yeah. So when his buddies called up and said, hey, we're making another movie. I got a part for you. He'd just kind of come in, do the part, and leave. And so I thought that was kind of a fascinating thing. There's a couple actors like that. And it's just kind of like they just kind of worked outside the studio system. But I guess they had enough cachet that as a character actor that people would just call him up and bring him into their movies.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting, too, because he was on Navy Reserve for a really long time. And apparently he like turned down a couple of times to become admiral.
Well, yeah, because he wasn't focused on the reserve. He was just part of it.
I know, but I just thought that was kind of interesting. And then Janet
Gaynor.
I was going to get there.
I know.
Janet Gaynor. She's pretty fascinating too. Just a couple of fun facts about her is that she's the first woman / person to ever win an Oscar for actress in a leading role for her roles in Seven Heaven, Street Angel, and this movie, Sunrise. And the reason why I've named three movies is because the first Oscar ceremony was about the body of work that year.
Yes.
Not a specific art piece.
Yeah, I think, and some people argue that mentality has lived on even past that, because that's why you see some actresses and actors get an Oscar for maybe a role that they were good in, but not their best. And it's basically saying, we're giving you this Oscar for your body of work versus this particular performance.
To be completely honest, I can totally understand that idea. But yeah. Granted, they were also making a lot more movies than we do today. Well, okay, and actually, that's a lie.
And
because
the Oscars
we do make more movies than they did then, but I'm saying more actors make more movies yearly because they were only short and you could move around and stuff.
Well, no, but the original Oscars were only done every 2 years. So you were adding up. You were adding up roles over 2 years. So it was a body of work. And I think it's like the first two or three, I forget when they went to yearly, but it was fairly shortly afterwards that they went to yearly. Yeah.
Technically she won the Academy Award because they weren't known as the Oscars until much later.
Yeah.
But she also, if you're a Lady Gaga fan, she's also the original star in The Star is Born. It's also her only Technicolor film that she's ever made. So it's the same.
Yeah.
It's the same plot, and I've watched it once, and I can't remember what her character name is, but she plays the Lady Gaga character in her version.
I think that's the thing about A Star is Born. It's one of those films that you can remake for every generation.
It was kind of funny to me. This is a tangent, and I apologize for it, but it was kind of a funny thing to me. I did not go see it with my roommates when they went to go see it. And they were like, they came back and they're like, it was such a sad movie. He did all this stuff. And I was like, yeah. And they're like, how are you not shocked? And I'm like, because that's the other two movies of The Star Is Born.
Oh, there's like more than two versions.
Well, the two main versions that I've seen, which is this one and the Barbra Streisand one, and okay. then the Lady Gaga one eventually.
I'm asking two questions. One, what did you think about this film? But more importantly, before you answer that question, answer this one. Do you see how these films like these have continued to influence the cinema?
The thing about German Expressionism, I don't think I could... German Expressionism in cinema, I'm going to just label it as in cinema, has definitely affected a lot of genres even to this day. Like, you got, you know, Metropolis affecting the design of C-3PO, and you've got Dr. Mabuse and the movie The Laughing Man that contributes to the Joker's from DC Comics look and character. But you also got directors like Ridley Scott and Tim Burton who use, you know, the mirrors, the stylized set, the optical illusions, the, you know, elongated shadows, and mostly the aesthetic, because Tim Burton and Ridley Scott are known for their aesthetic, inspired by the German Expressionist movement. And you see the effect of it in genres, like the horror genre, the use of shadows in film noir and things like that, and gangster films and things like that. So I definitely can see why films like this are really important in film history.
Did you like the film?
I did enjoy the film. I got peeved that they got together at the end, but they had to because that's the story.
Well, it's a song. It's a song.
Yes. Anytime a person tries to murder their significant other, I kind of view that as a red flag, but that might just be my modern ways. So,
yes.
I did really enjoy this film. Like you said, it does feel modern, so it wasn't really hard for me to understand. I did think it was funny that we had to have subtitles for a silent film because of the different language title cards. But also, all the silent films that I have watched before have always been like within the 5 minute to 45 minute mark.
And this is a full length.
This was a full length film.
There was actually a lot of full length, what we would consider full length films at that time. I mean, and some of the, and I think another thing I wanted to show you is that films weren't all herky jerky.
Mm-hmm.
So like a lot of that herky jerkiness is that the fact that they shot a lot of those films at 18 frames per second. And then when they went to sound, they shot the films at 24 frames per second. So when they started transferring some of these films, they didn't have the right equipment. So you would get this herky jerky movement when they were transferring the film to DVD or whatever medium they were transferring the film to. And so that herky jerky movement was created through the preservation process of trying to save some of these films. So that's why this film, which they've gone back and restored, doesn't have any of that. And you'll see a lot of films.
Very smooth for a silent film.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to say. It's like this, as part of the point of why I wanted to show you, is like these films weren't.
Because in our mind, when people usually say silent films, what I think of is a man and a woman in a jokey costume dancing to do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do type songs. And that's what comes to mind when someone says silent films. And this definitely broke that stereotype in my brain.
Would you be willing to watch more silent films?
Yes. I do think I would be.
Like some of the Charlie Chaplin, like some like the full-on Charlie Chaplin, not just the shorts, but.
Well, I have watched some of Charlie Chaplin's shorts, which is one of the, you know, 5 to 45 minute ones. I've also seen a silent film, Tempest.
Yep, which is really good.
Which I really enjoy. But again, that was cut down to like 25 to 45 minutes. I don't think I watched all of it though, so that might be a lie. So there has definitely been some silent films that I've watched, but they've definitely been that like stereotypical early silent film where it's like title card, set, stage, camera doesn't move, the people move around the camera. And then,
well, yeah, there's some like that, and there's, and then, but even Chaplin and I really enjoy Keaton. So maybe we'll show you, I'll show you some Keaton stuff where the camera is moving around and stuff, and some of the early westerns.
I do enjoy Michael Keaton too.
No,
I'm just Buster kidding. Keaton. I know who
you're talking about. But like some of the early western stuff, where I could show you like some of the stuff that they weren't as locked down. They were very fluid story wise. They were very complicated. And they expected you to keep up with it. So, yeah.
So, Dad, would you recommend this film?
Yeah, I would recommend this film for anybody who wants to watch a really, really good silent film. So, yeah. So, unfortunately, F.W. Murnau only made two movies after this that he was able to complete that were sound. He shot them as silent film. The studio made him go back and reshoot parts of them as sound. He never really liked the films. They weren't really well received. He broke away from Fox and started to do this film called Taboo with Robert Flaherty, which is another reason why is another famous person in film history, because he did the what is considered the first documentary. I think it's called Nanook of the North. And he went off to the Polynesian Islands and made this movie called Taboo. But unfortunately he died in a car crash a week before the movie was released. You know, it's a sad thing that he didn't get to like go deeper into sound films. Cause I think he would have eventually brought the type of filmmaking that he did in like Nosferatu and Sunrise into
Faust too.
And Faust. I mean, it'd been interesting to see if he may have made one of the original like Frankenstein or Dracula. It's been interesting to see if he'd been the director that they picked for that. You know what I'm saying? So anyway.
Do you want to know cool, fun facts about his death?
Okay, what?
So cool thing about his death, sad fact about his death is that he was going to a meeting in this car. He was taking a shortcut because earlier that week, a fortune teller told him that he was going to die in a car. In the car crash. So he was only taking a shortcut to a meeting, and then he was going to get his car, his actual car, shipped through the Panama Canal to New York, or he was already into New York, and he was going to take a boat to New York the long way because he didn't want to die in a car crash, but he died on the way to that plan. Also, in 2015... In July of 2015, his skull was stolen from his gravesite. It was broken into and his skull was taken.
Do you know why?
No. And nobody has been apprehended. And I just think that's kind of like a fun little fact.
All right. Well, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. You can follow us on Instagram at TML, A Journey Through Cinema. On Twitter at TMLA Journey, and on Facebook under The Movie Log or The Movie Log 1. We also have a website, which is TMLAJourneyThroughCinema.com, where you can find past episodes, leave reviews, and also ask questions.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.